Hi, Michael Bean. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Thane. How are you?
Very well, and it's good to talk with you again.
Indeed.
You and I have known each other, and you are very well known for your long involvement with the Endangered Species Act. I know it's often said that Michael Bean wrote the Endangered Species Act. I'm imagining it's a little more complex than that, but tell how that happened, because that was really world-changing legislation a long time ago.
Well, to set the record straight, I did not write the act. That was Congress's doing in 1973, but you are certainly correct that it was a momentous event because it, for the first time, reflected a commitment to try to bring to a halt the loss of species, both plant and animal, in this country that we had the power to conserve. And it has put in place a set of programs that has been quite successful in saving not only our national symbol, the bald eagle, but many other species once faced with the threat of extinction.
I was around at that time and remember some of those initial animals on the endangered species list, such as the American alligator from where I grew up in Florida. And a goodly number of those early animals have been taken off the list, even though, of course, the list does continue to grow. From afar, it feels to me like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service putting in specific recovery plans is a huge part of what's made the act successful.
Yes, I think that's true. The recovery plans have guided the efforts of the Fish and Wildlife Service, other federal agencies, very importantly the states as well, in trying to work together to achieve some improvement in the status of these species. And you're right, some of these species have been on the list for a long time but are making major headway. For example, the California condor and the black-footed ferret are both species that were once gone from the wild. The only surviving members were a few in captivity, and both of those species have been bred successfully in captivity, reintroduced to the wild where they are now breeding naturally in the wild. So even though those are still endangered species, they represent extraordinary accomplishments.
Now, over the years, you have had a fascinating career in Washington and certainly as at least what I've often called the chief counsel to the natural world. You were at Natural Resources Defense Council. I think now you're with the Department of Interior. So tell a bit about that.
Well, actually, it was Environmental Defense Fund I was with for many years.
There you go.
Before coming to the Interior Department. I had the opportunity in the mid-1970s to write a book on wildlife law called The Evolution of National Wildlife Law. And writing that book then gave me an opportunity to go to work for, at the time, Environmental Defense Fund. And I spent most of my career there focused on conserving rare wildlife, and in particular focusing on working with private landowners who are key to the success of many conservation efforts, trying to make private landowners allies of conservation, not as adversaries. I think that work caught the attention of former Interior Secretary Salazar, who invited me to come to work for the department in 2009, where I've been ever since.
So, Michael, give us a bit of your reflection, and in this case with 40-plus years really at the front lines with what's going on with wildlife and conservation law. Millions of dollars get spent every year. If you look around the world, I guess we could say billions. Are we making progress or falling back, or what's your take on that?
Well, we've clearly have made a great deal of progress for both for many species and for many ecosystems. Certainly, I think those of us who are my age or yours, Thane, remember some of the major problems with air and water pollution in the 1960s that have largely been successfully addressed. In terms of conserving wildlife resources, we've made tremendous progress in conserving the species I already mentioned, plus wolves, grizzly bears, peregrine falcons, brown pelicans, and many others. Now, it's not all good news. There are certainly many species that continue to decline, species that are in serious peril still. But overall, I think the successes have demonstrated that we have it within our power to change the fortunes of many of these species that appear to be headed toward extinction and to put them back on the road to recovery.
Absolutely. Like the old business adage, what gets measured is what gets managed. And if people are paying attention, that's much better than just ignoring as things disappear. So perhaps for listeners, you could describe a bit of this. Periodically, you'll read, say, in a journal or the paper, such as recently, that the African lion was being considered for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And while most listeners know, you know, the bald eagle lives here and the peregrine falcon lives here, of course, African lions live in sub-Saharan Africa. So what impact would, if you will, on a species from 1,000 or in that case, 4,000 miles away, how would the U.S. Endangered Species Act impact them?
Well, you're certainly correct in your recognition that the Act covers both foreign and domestic species. It has its greatest impact for those species that are here in the United States because we can, through the Act, influence or direct activities that might be harmful to those species here. For foreign species, our tools are more limited. Basically, we have the power to regulate the importation of foreign species so as to prevent wildlife trafficking from becoming a major threat. And we can provide and do provide some technical assistance to foreign governments and foreign counterparts to help them implement conservation programs. But obviously, for foreign species, the main responsibility for conserving them rests with the countries where those species occur. We can help, but they have to play the lead role. But that said, certainly it has been very helpful to have the Fish and Wildlife Service draw attention to the plight of many of these foreign species, whether it's African lions or African elephants or rhinoceroses or other species. The efforts of the U.S. have helped dramatize the challenge of conserving those species.
And in that way, I've always held up that the Endangered Species Act and the recovery programs that go with it are among the very best role models and case studies of success, because they've gone back a long, long way, as you mentioned, with some species that without it probably wouldn't have had a shot, such as wolves in the lower 48, and quite a comeback. I'm assuming that probably some foreign wildlife programs that are emerging have used these as models, and is that the case?
Yes, I believe so, that the U.S. endangered species law is generally looked to in the rest of the world as an example of how to do things well, and people elsewhere in the world have tried to replicate that to the extent possible. I want to point out that also contributing to our success in recovering species has been the partnership formed with lots of institutions, including your own Cincinnati Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
I know your zoo has been instrumental in captive breeding of many endangered species, as well as promoting the conservation of endangered species generally. And frankly, your efforts and those of your fellow colleagues in the zoo community have been quite helpful in providing the public support and understanding of this issue.
Well, thank you for that. And it is true, there's a good blending of field biology and conservation in wild areas, in situ, as it were, as well as with captive breeding, and certainly public education and zoos play that role. Now, in a 40-year career and with, at times, a controversial topic like the Endangered Species Act, Michael, you must have had some debates, arm wrestling, battles, fights, I don't know, any stories to retell from that?
Well, let me just talk about one current controversy, and that is the potential that the Fish and Wildlife Service might propose to list the greater sage-grouse as a threatened or endangered species. This is a bird that occurs in 11 western states. And if it's listed, that listing could have some substantial impact upon oil and gas development, transmission, coal mining, and other activities. There is an unparalleled effort underway involving 4 federal agencies, 11 states, and many private parties to try to put in place measures that will address the threats of that species and avoid the need to list that species. That's been one of the good, encouraging things that I have seen emerge from 40 years of experience. People are not waiting for these species to become endangered before they act. They're trying to anticipate threats, head off threats, and avoid the need to list these species. Our goal is not to have species on the list, it's to keep them off and to get them off if they do happen to get on the list. And the sage-grouse is an example of a species where I think there is a real shot at keeping it off the list through these coordinated efforts of state, local, and federal agencies.
And certainly the sage-grouse is worth that effort. I was lucky to see them years ago on a spring day in Wyoming, and man alive, on the lek, the males were competing. It was fantastic. But I also know from spending some time in the American West, it's not as easy as you're making it sound, because this is an interesting part. What I have found, in fact, all over the world, it isn't so much that, say, ranchers don't like wolves, or certainly folks out west don't like sage-grouse, but they hate like heck having somebody tell them what to do.
Well, I think that's right, and that's why in administering the Endangered Species Act, this department, the Department of Interior, has tried to offer incentives to try to align the goals and objectives of landowners with the goals and objectives of conservation. Because when we're all pulling in the same direction, we have a much better chance of getting across the finish line successfully. There have been, no doubt, some examples in which landowners and others have felt unhappy with or have felt that they've been told what to do, and they would like to avoid that. I think this department recognizes that the most gains for conservation can come about through collaboration and cooperation.
That is great. So briefly, after all these years of involvement, I was thinking when you and I were last together at a conference, it might be 20 years ago, so time flies. So with everything you know, Michael, are you hopeful for the future of wildlife?
Very much so. I think examples through the Endangered Species Act and other laws here in this country demonstrate that one can make a real difference in the welfare and well-being of these wild creatures. I think the public support for wildlife conservation mm-hmm. has always been and remains extremely high. And I think all of those are reasons for optimism.
I agree, as is, that you're still doing great work. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. It's really been an honor.
Thank you, Thane. Good to talk to you.
My guest has been Michael Bean, the U.S. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.